Where can you go in Westchester with your entire family and encompass all those things? Well, there's one place, and if you haven't already guessed, it's New Rock City in New Rochelle. Everything is made to order for you and your family to enjoy. Whether it's 18 movie theaters or a 17-lane bowling alley, miniature golf, pool and billiards, video arcades, family restaurants, kids' parties to delight all ages, New Rock City has it all for you and yours. Family fun is back in style again, and New Rock City is simply the best thing to happen for families in Westchester County. They've made it their business to make your comfort level exactly that. Comfortable by being together and having a fun time. New Rock City, a place you'll want to go back to time and time again, right in the heart of New Rochelle. Just take I-95 to exit 16 or take the Hutchinson River Parkway, New Rock City, where family fun is waiting for you.
Get your weather 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by calling the Whitney Radio Weather Phone at 914-636-7026, a service of Union State Bank. Now at Union State Bank, free checking, no monthly charges, no per check fees. Just $100 to open at Union State Bank. Union State Bank sponsors the Whitney Radio Weather Phone at 914-636-7026. That's 914-636-7026.
Weather forecast for Westchester County and vicinity are skies at the moment generally clear. Looks like a pretty good day coming up, but on the chilly side, it'll be sunny for the morning hours, partly sunny for this afternoon. Our high temperatures for today into the mid-40s. That's a range of about 43 to 48 degrees. Now, for tonight, mostly cloudy. Overnight lows into the lower 30s. Friday's looking mostly cloudy. There's a possibility of some rain showers afternoon and evening, or highs of the day in the upper 40s. Lows at night will range in the mid-30s. Now, look for Saturday. Calls for some rain or snow showers in the morning, then becoming partly sunny. Our highs on Saturday will range into the upper 40s. In our extended outlook, it looks like Sunday, Veterans Day, will be mostly sunny in the lower 50s. Sunny Monday and Tuesday, both days, our temperatures will range into the 50s. There's a chance of some rain by Wednesday of next week. I'm meteorologist Steve Pelletieri for WVOX and WVIP, the Whitney Radio Network.
The latest forecast from the 1460 WVOX Weather Center, brought to you by Entergy and the Indian Point Energy Center, right for New York.
At Entergy, meeting our region's need for reliable, affordable, and clean electricity is an everyday success story. That's because our Indian Point Energy Center supplies up to 38% of the region's power needs. It also produces some of the least expensive power generated in the region. And most importantly, it does not produce greenhouse gas emissions. That's right, zero greenhouse gases. This plays a key role in helping this area improve its air quality. So it should come as no surprise that a growing number of environmentalists, including Dr. Patrick Moore, the co-founder of Greenpeace, say nuclear power is a vital tool in the fight against global warming. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.safesecurevital.com. Because the more you know, the more you realize that Indian Point's clean, reliable, and affordable energy is a big part of the climate change solution.
I never dreamed of what it would feel like to lose my only child. I watched her flying towards the windshield, and I closed my eyes. But what I didn't see was a seatbelt pulling her back into place, saving her life, giving my daughter a chance to pursue her dreams, and giving me the chance to watch her do it.
You've been given the gift of life, so why take a chance on losing it? Get it together. Buckle up.
Sponsored by the New York State Governor's Traffic Safety Committee in cooperation with the New York State Broadcasters Association.
This is Ruby D. As I travel around the country, I'm struck by this unique radio station's extraordinary relationship with this community. There's always something happening right here at 1460 1460, and most of it very good.
I never dreamed of what it would feel like to lose my only child. I watched her flying towards the windshield, and I closed my eyes. But what I didn't see was a seatbelt pulling her back into place, saving her life, giving my daughter a chance to pursue her dreams, and giving me the chance to watch her do it.
You've been given the gift of life, so why take a chance on losing it? Get it together. Buckle up.
Sponsored by the New York State Governor's Traffic Safety Committee in cooperation with the New York State Broadcasters Association.
This program is brought to you by the Westchester County Press, founded in 1928. The County Press is today the only black-owned newspaper in the northern suburbs. Published every week, the County Press is a lively, provocative journal that speaks to the issues and concerns of African-American families of substance and means. This unique publication delivers an upscale, successful, and highly influential readership base for any suburban advertising or marketing campaign. Featuring the irreverent musings of Star Feature columnist Snoopy Allgood and the thoughtful pronouncements of longtime activist M. Paul Redd, the County Press is one of Westchester's most valuable assets. For advertising and subscription information, an entire year for just $25, call 914-684-0006 or send your check for $25 to the Westchester County Press, Box 152, Elmsford, New York. The number for the publisher and Oriel Redd, the editor, is 684-0006.
The voice of Westchester, 1460 WVOX.
Good morning, and welcome to Environmentally Sound. I am Bob Levinsold, your host for the series on the natural world, education, and culture. We bring you guests from diverse disciplines, scientists, activists, authors, educators, entertainers, and public officials. We seek to stimulate your curiosity, intellect, and passion. Today's news from the natural world. Today is Thursday, November 8th, 2007, the 47th day of autumn. We have lost 2 minutes of daylight since yesterday, 32 minutes since last we met 2 weeks ago. The sun rose at 6:34 this morning. It will set at 4:44 this evening. We will have 10 hours and 10 minutes of daylight today. The moon rose at 5:22 this morning. It will set at 3:44 tomorrow morning. The new moon is tomorrow, which means you won't see it. Next full phase is on November 24th, and the winter solstice occurs on December 22nd, which will put an end to this shorter day nonsense and get us back on track, gaining minutes instead of losing them each day, as it has gone on since time began and will continue until it ends. Tide information, you'll just have to wait a second. We're so well prepared on Environmentally Sound. Well, we will give you the tides because you're entitled to that. Next high tide in New Rochelle, 10.05 a.m. It's actually very high right now, 5 minutes ago. In Yonkers, 8.02 a.m. That's 8.18 p.m. In Dobbs Ferry, 8.46 p.m. Tarrytown, 9.02. And in Peekskill, 9.41 p.m. is your next high tide. Now our regular feature, the sad part of our program, the names of American service members who have lost their lives in Iraq. May they live on in all of our hearts. Eric T. Garut, age 22, he was in the Marines from Santee, California. He died on October 19th. Jared S. Fontenot, which is a good Cajun name, and of course he's from Port Barre, Louisiana, age 35, from the Army. He died on the 18th of October. Vincent A. Madero, age 22, from the Army, Port Hueneme, California. I doubt if I pronounced that right, but that's the way it's spelled. That's Vincent A. Madero, 22, of the Army. He died on the 17th of October. John T. Hicks, Jr., 20, age 20, of the Marines, Atco, New Jersey, died on September 10th. Michael D. Brown, age 20. You know, just seeing these small numbers. I mean, if the guy was 80 and he died in over there, I'd say, okay, he had a life, but 20. He's from the Army, Williamsburg, Kansas, October 16th. Alexander U. Gagalak, age 28, Army from Wahiawa, Hawaii, died on September 9th. And on the second anniversary of his death, Alwin C. Cash, age 35, he died at age 35. He was in the Army from Oviedo, Florida, and he died on this date, November 8th, in 2005. May these American soldiers and Marines live forever in our hearts, and may this feature come to an end in the very near future, because there are no more deaths to report. And the last time I looked, it was 3,000 and about 700. And I dread that 4,000 is coming. Hopefully this will end before, as I say, in the very near future, because there are no more deaths to report. Okay, time for the Culture Corner, my reviews of plays, ballets, opera, museums, and what have you. Keep in mind that these are my opinions and that you have the right to differ from them, because everyone has the right to be wrong. Okay, the American Ballet Theater at City Center, they had two world premieres. This is on the program a week ago Saturday night. They had three ballet segments. The first was called Clear, and this is a repertory piece by Australian choreographer Stanton Welch. Bach's music is superb, but the ballet itself left me a little cold. Ordinary dancing, not to say that these fine dancers are ordinary by any stretch, but in this particular case it wasn't so exciting. And I also find it unbalanced when a dance is performed by six men and only two women. It just seems unnatural to me. Second on the program was a world premiere piece called Sea to Sea, which is close to Chuck. And there's a little play on words there. Chuck is Chuck Close, the scenery designer who is confined to a wheelchair. Mr. Close's painting of Philip Glass, who is still working at age 70, resulted in a solo piano homage to Close that reflects an abstract of events in Close's life and the long friendship between the two men. The dancers portrayed highlights from Close's life through dance, which on occasion resembled mime and at other times seemed almost like the Vogue moves that Madonna made popular in the 80s. In one segment, the dancer contorted his body to illustrate the condition which was destined to cripple Mr. Close. Excellently danced. Very interesting. He contorted it, and you could tell that he was losing the use of his legs just by the way he danced. But you know, it's a lot easier for a wise man to play a fool than for a fool to play a wise man. Great versatility of the dancers. I didn't know how to feel. Was I sad for Mr. Close's condition? Was I uplifted by the dancers' movements? Was I awed by Finnish choreographer Jorma Ilo's unique moves? Perfect conflict of emotion that makes such art stay with you for longer than just the few minutes it takes to play out on the stage. In the opening scene, the men wear long black skirts, which seem to inhibit their movements, but they soon shed those. Now, the last selection, which was also a world premiere, was choreographed by Benjamin Millepied, who worked with Philip Glass at the tender age of 18. This was the loudest, most dramatic music on the program. But again, it's the emotions evoked by the music and the dance that is most important in neoclassical works, and that is ballets without a story. American Ballet Theatre's fall season at the City Center usually consists of a group of modern works. Saturday was no exception. The dancers' versatility is amply showcased in these works as they move fluidly among styles from classical to modern and back again. Let me just tell you, ABT, American Ballet Theatre, it is a classical company. They usually have ballets with stories like Swan Lake, Romeo and Juliet, Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty. Occasionally they do this, what we call neoclassical, which is no stories. But they do such a good job. If you like dance, stay informed about their works. Take in some of their fine performances. Not likely to disappoint, no matter which program they perform. These guys are really good. If you like ballet, it doesn't really matter about this particular one or which one you go to see. I never fail to be happy when I see these things. Now, last Saturday, November 3rd, I had the privilege of going to the kickoff of the 11th season of the Westchester Chamber Orchestra. This was in Iona College's Joyce Auditorium right here in New Rochelle near our studios. The first selection was Mozart's Paris Symphony, which was the 31st of his symphony. He wrote 41. Not one of Mozart's best. We don't hear much about most of Mozart's symphonies, but the 40th, of course, is sublime. And the 41st is pretty darn good, and there's a couple of others. But the 31st, you know, he Mozart was so prolific. He died when he was about 35, I think. And he just, some of his stuff, you just sit there in awe that an imagination could come up with this stuff. So this 31st was ordinary for Mozart, but extraordinary for almost any other composer. Conductor Barry Charles Hoffman's interpretation is lively, and the musicians who make up this fine orchestra are up to his considerable demands of pacing and gusto. Mozart's Clarinet Concerto, the second piece they played, is another matter entirely. This is one of Mozart's best, and there are melodic places in the score which make one want to soar above the auditorium, be liberated from human limitations, transfixed and transformed for those moments into eagles gliding high and majestic above the fruited plain. Well, above the Murphy Science Center, anyway. Again, the Westchester Chamber Orchestra was up to the challenge. The core orchestra provided the platform from which soloist Christopher Cullen launched the sublime melodies and counterpoints of the master. Maestro Hoffman is the rocket which drives them upward and the safety net which guides them back to this mortal coil to set softly back to earth, integrity and dignity intact. The final piece was a lightweight Schubert Symphony No. 5. It was well executed, musically sort of kind of halfway interesting, to use the technical terms. There are three more concerts in the series. Next up, December 15th, with some Telemann and some of Bach's most popular compositions. If you have the time, it cannot be better spent than at one of WCO's concerts. Their work is much better than you might expect from a regional group. Okay, we have a couple of guests on the phone and one gentleman in our studio. First, we want to speak with Jeff Rook. If you have Jeff on the phone, he's executive director of PEER, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, for the last 10 years. Speaking to us from Washington, D.C., welcome, Jeff Rook.
Good morning.
Good morning, Jeff. Today is the day that Chief Teresa Chambers has a hearing down there in Washington, D.C.
In federal court.
As most of us know by now, she was removed peremptorily by the Bush administration because she simply told the truth. And in fact, she was the authorized spokesperson for the United States Park Police. Just in a couple of minutes, just give us a quick intro to Chief Chambers and what today's hearing means.
Chief Chambers was recruited actually by the Bush administration following a nationwide search to modernize the U.S. Park Police, which is the oldest uniform force in federal service. It was founded by President George Washington. And it's responsible for not only all the parks in the nation's capital, but the parkways, the National Mall, the monuments, as well as things like the Statue of Liberty, perimeter security, Camp David, and other functions. She found after she was hired in 2002 that she didn't have the resources to do what was expected of her, and she wasn't shy about letting people know about it. There was increasing tension within the department that appeared to culminate when she was asked to respond to the Washington Post, who had been given internal documents by the Park Police Union showing that the shortfalls were so much that they were having to pull officers out of the parkways and the parks, basically leaving the roads and parks unpoliced. She admitted what was true, and 2 days after the article was published, she was called to the director's office, where there was no director, but there were armed security guards, and she was ordered to surrender her badge and gun and identification, put in custody, and marched in front of her shock staff out into the street. She was then left on paid administrative leave for almost 8 months, and when she finally filed a formal legal challenge to her suspension with pay, she was fired. And because of the creaky system that we have, it's taken nearly 4 years, because these events took place in early December 2003, and we're coming upon December of 2007.
What's happening today, Jeff?
She's her case is being heard before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. So it's the first time a federal court will review the administration decision. So far, all of the decisions about Teresa Chambers have been made by basically appointees of the Bush administration. So this will be the first independent review of what was done and whether it was legal.
And in fact, that hearing was scheduled to start at 10 a.m. this morning, so most likely it's happening at this very moment.
It is.
Okay, well, we wish Chief Chambers the best, of course. I emailed her yesterday, and she was happy that to hear that I was involved with it. And, of course, we want to hear much more about it as soon as anything comes up, as soon as there's any news to report. I hope you will call me or email me. And
the
I hope,
wheels of justice slowly turn again.
Well, let's hope that they're really wheels of justice and not just the wheels of chewing innocent people up and spitting them out. Let's hope that they turn properly. Okay, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today, and please do again in the near future and keep us posted.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Jeff. Okay, my next guest is Shannon Wilson. He's with the League of Wilderness Defenders in Oregon, speaking to us from Eugene, Oregon, I believe. Welcome, Shannon Wilson.
Good morning.
Good morning. Are you, in fact, in Eugene?
Yes, I am.
Yes,
Eugene, Oregon.
And it is, in fact, 7:22 a.m. out there on the West Coast.
Yep.
Okay. The reason that we have you on today, let me just read a quote that I picked up. Ancient forest, again, is on the chopping block by the Bureau of Land Management in Oregon. They're preparing to cut 1 million acres of old-growth forest. The plan is not finalized, so opposition is still possible. Hope do we have? It says the plan is not finalized, so opposition is not possible. Just how much opposition and what form does that have to take for us to defeat this? Go ahead. I don't know how to form the question. Just answer it.
It's a proposal right now for the BLM, and they're putting together environmental impact statements. And their proposal is basically the first 10 years, they would cut about 140,000 acres of ancient forests. And that's forests, 200 to 400 years old, the trees themselves inside the forest. That's about 10,000 football fields per year. And this is going to be like what they're calling a 100-year plan. And, this is going to affect endangered species negatively, like the northern spotted owl, the marbled murrelet, salmon species. They're going in the opposite direction. They think they need to follow a mandate that was created back in 1937 called the Oregon and California Railroads Act, when lands were taken back from the railroads and then turned over to the Department of Interior. And that act has been in effect since 1937.
Okay, now he wants... he's putting in place, he being, of course, the unmentionable environmental disaster president, he is putting something in place that will take place that will occur long after he's gone. Can the next president just throw this out and say that was ridiculous? Let's put a kibosh on this right now. Or are there commitments that must be followed even in his retirement, shall we say?
Well, the timber industry came to bat for the Bush administration every time they came to Oregon. In 2000 and 2004. The timber barons in Oregon gave George Bush and the Republican Party about $1 million each time he came. So this is kind of what the timber barons get in payment back, is this, 100,000 acres of old-growth forests, or up to 1 million acres over 100 years in payment.
So, but that 100 years, Shannon, that 100 years, I mean, it's not engraved in stone, is it? Just because Bush signs it off? I mean, as soon as Hillary becomes president, can't she turn it around?
Well, the timber industry is counting on, this will be implemented in some sort of policy as far as agency law.
Well, but
which would take time to fix.
Bush has thrown all kinds of things. As soon as he came in, he just nixed every treaty that was ever signed, everything that America ever stood for. He just threw everything out. So can't somebody throw all his stuff out?
All these things, and that's what the timber industry is depending on. It'll take time, and years could go by before this thing could be fixed. So what we're trying to get people to do is call the Secretary of Interior, Dirk Kempthorne, currently, and demand that the BLM stop this process and stay with the current laws.
Okay.
And in fact, what we need to do, because even with the current laws, they're allowed to continue logging old growth forests. Not as much as they're proposing now, but currently, even before this plan has been implemented, there's approximately 39 square miles of timber sales that are currently already planned and ready to be cut.
Shannon,
in Oregon.
Let me ask you a question. This is the way I get it, and it seems incredible that America could possibly allow such a thing to happen, but then again, we've allowed torture, so maybe they do. The timber industry filed a lawsuit as soon as George W. Bush became president to overthrow whatever protections Bill Clinton put together in 1994, I believe, right? Clinton and Al Gore had a forest summit, and they put together this plan to protect old growth forest and salmon and owls and the murrelet and those other things in 1994. As soon as Bush took over, the timber industry filed a lawsuit, and the administration said, well, we don't want to go to court. We'll just settle this out of court, and we'll give you everything you want. Is it possible that that's the way it actually happened?
That's the way it actually happened. The Justice Department just decided, oh, we're not going to fight this. We're just going to settle out of court. Timber barons what they wanted.
They decided they're not going to fight this, or it was established before they ever got in and says, okay, just wait till we're in, file the suit, and we'll give you what you want.
Oh, well, there may have been deals made.
May have been.
backroom deals made before the Bush administration even got into office.
You mean like the backroom deals that they made with Halliburton and Blackwater and other contractors, that they would start a war in Iraq and they'd have all the contracts before he ever got in the White House, and then he used 9/11 as an excuse, that kind of deal?
I'm not familiar with all those deals that were made, but it sounds very familiar.
I love to put guests on the spot. I'm outspoken, and some people are a little more cautious, but I'm glad that you're at least you don't deny that those are some things that can happen. Okay, so the Bureau of Land Management is accepting public comments until January 11th, so any listeners who are outraged by this, as I am, get in touch with, I guess, the Secretary of the Interior, or just anybody that you would ordinarily call with a protest, congressmen, senators, in the local area, Anita Lowy, our congresswoman, just get the word out that you're unhappy with what they're trying to do in Oregon and stop it. Is that about right?
Yeah, and another thing, just to the bigger picture, some of these forests hold up to 1,000 tons of carbon per acre, these old growth forests.
Right.
And so you do the numbers, 143,000 acres cut in 10 years, you're basically adding about 330 tons of carbon to the atmosphere for every acre that you cut over that 10 years. So, and the analogy I've used before is, we're on the U.S. Titanic here, heading for, a big, we're going down. And the BLM is, instead of, helping people get into the lifeboats, they're actually sabotaging the lifeboats and sinking them by cutting these forests. And we need to save all these forests here in the Northwest and in the Northeast, wherever you are, because these forests are basically part of the lifeboat that we're going to need to sequester all this carbon.
And as the actual analogy you used when we spoke on the phone, you said we are the Titanic and the BLM is just rearranging the deck chairs.
Well, they're actually sabotaging the lifeboat.
They're even doing worse than nothing. They're doing the okay. Shannon Wilson, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. We will be back with Eric Byron, who is in our studio today. Fascinating guy, and we'll introduce you to him after the break. First, before we go on the break, I'd like to just tell you that Environmentally Sound is brought to you in part by the Learning Shop in Harrison. The Learning Shop is a full-service tutoring company, as you know, which provides homebound services for upwards of 20 Westchester County school districts. You don't get 20 school districts on your team to use you and pay you all that money if you're not doing the right job. In addition, they also provide private tutoring in all academic areas for any number of standardized tests, including GEDs and the SATs. You can reach them at 914-835-1070. If you have need for any education, anything, even if you don't have the money to spend, if you have questions, call the Learning Shop at 914-835-1070. And I'll have just a very quick announcement. Every year they have a Christmas songwriting contest, which I have been part of for the last few years. They coerce me each year. I'm not much of a competitor, but I am a songwriter. So I will write another Christmas song this year. And the winner, unless it is me, of the contest comes on to this program. We play that new Christmas song and we interview the songwriter. So that's something for you to look forward to either in December, probably in early January. Okay. If you're listening in a local area, you are listening to AM 1460 WVOX here in New Rochelle. If you're listening in Lahaina, Hawaii, Mino, North Dakota, Alamo, Tennessee, Coos Bay, Oregon, or Enoch, Utah, you have logged on to www.wvox.com and you are listening live. We'll be right back with Eric Byron and we will be right back.
This program is brought to you by the Westchester County Press, founded in 1928. The County Press is today the only black-owned newspaper in the northern suburbs. Published every week, the County Press is a lively, provocative journal that speaks to the issues and concerns of African-American families of substance and means. This unique publication delivers an upscale, successful, and highly influential readership base for any suburban advertising or marketing campaign. Featuring the irreverent musings of star feature columnist Snoopy Allgood and the thoughtful pronouncements of longtime activist M. Paul Redd, The County Press is one of Westchester's most valuable assets. For advertising and subscription information, an entire year for just $25, call 914-684-0006 or send your check for $25 to the Westchester County Press, Box 152, Elmsford, New York. The number for the publisher and Oriel Red, the editor, is 684-0006.
Now in Westchester, for corporate travel, executive transportation, and custom limousine service, the leader, clearly, is Excel. After two decades in the county, Rich Guberti's Excel Transportation Service does just that. Specializing in sedans, limos, and 14-passenger vans, Excel is the new class of the fleet and the Westchester leader in terms of cars, service, resources, and the quality of their Excel drivers. Most of the Golden Apple's blue-chip companies have, in fact, in recent years, switched to Excel for local transportation and city-to-city service to Washington, Albany, Baltimore, Hartford, Boston, and Philadelphia at rates even less than rail or air. And you can use them too for a trip into town, the airport, or any special occasion. Call President Rich Guberti at Excel Headquarters, EXCEL Transportation, 576-9797, 914-576-9797. These days in Westchester, the new car service leader, because Excel excels. 576-9797. From the historic city of New Rochelle, home of the Dick Van Dyke Show, Lou Bacardi, head of the Associated Press, Eddie Foy, and the Sound Shore Medical Center of Westchester, the great and growing hospital for you and yours.
The voice of Westchester, 1460 WVOX.
I could listen to that music all day. Maybe we'll just listen to the music. No, that's all right. We're back. We are back. Turn the music off. We are back. That is, of course, Beethoven's string quartet opus. I forget the opus, but it's string quartet number 13 in B-flat, the Alla Danza Tedesca movement, one of the most sublime refrains in music. Again, you're listening to WVOX AM 1460. If you are in our local area, if you are in Vancouver, Seattle, Portland, or San Diego, wherever, whatever states and countries those are in, you have logged on to www.wvox.com, and you are listening live. My next guest is Eric Byron, a member of the dive team at the Brooklyn Aquarium, a unit of the Wildlife Conservation Society, as is the Bronx Zoo, which is just a short hop down Pelham Road from our studios. Eric's fascinating occupation is diving into the fish displays. One can hardly call them tanks, as they have hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of gallons in them. That also is a unit of the Wildlife Conservation Society. Joining me live in the WVOX studio, welcome Eric Byron.
Good morning, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to have you here. And if anybody hears anything of interest and you'd like to call in, our telephone number is 914-636-0110. Eric, from what I gather from the website, a dive team member, actually you're involved in the maintenance. You clean, maintain the exhibits.
Correct.
And interact with aquarium guests. In fact,
yes.
I get the feeling that you walk around in scuba gear around just schmoozing patrons. Is that right?
That is part of the function that we do, yes. You know, the public is everything to the Wildlife Conservation Society and the New York Aquarium, so we try to make it as interesting for them as possible, and they love interacting with the divers. It's something that all of us look forward to. Yeah,
you're almost like one of the displays that is actually walking actually, and they can touch you and talk to you.
We are, yeah. They can see us in the water, in the tanks, and when we get out, we're walking around the park, and they ask a variety of questions, you know, kids, adults. It's really a lot of fun for
now,
divers.
Is this a new program? Because I haven't been to the aquarium so many times, but I've been there a few times and I've never seen a diver. Is it a new program or just...
No, the program has been around for years and years, and actually it's run by the dive safety officer, a gentleman by the name of Dick Blankfein, and he does an exceptional job in getting volunteer divers to come in. There are some staff divers there at the New York Aquarium, but most of the work is done by volunteer divers like myself.
What inspired you? Did you just see a flyer and say, "Well, I can dive. Let me go in there."
No, for me personally, it was it goes back to my roots in shark research. I was born and raised in the Bronx, and you know, most kids born and raised in the Bronx don't have an interest in marine biology or sharks. But when I saw Jaws in 75, it kind of fear turned to awe, awe turned to inspiration, inspiration turned to action. So I actually started about 10 years ago researching sharks seriously, and started diving seriously about 5 years ago.
So you have dived in the oceans with sharks?
Yes, yes I have.
Any of the dangerous ones, or just the nurse sharks and the la-di-da
well,
sharks?
No, nothing particularly dangerous. Whale sharks, a couple of nurse sharks, white tip reef sharks.
They can be dangerous, can't they, white tips?
Not really. Not really. No, unless you're a bleeding fish or a fish struggling in the reef.
The ones that are dangerous are the tigers, of course, the great whites.
Yes.
Hammerheads can be dangerous?
Hammerheads can be dangerous. Mostly there are about 400 species of shark, only about 10 of which are considered potentially dangerous, really, to human beings. There are shark attacks that take place with other species, but we're not the main diet for these animals. So usually it's a case of mistaken identity or being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
So we think of the great white shark as being the worst. Is that
the great white shark by far is the largest carnivorous fish in the ocean, and is certainly capable of attacking and killing a human being. The tiger shark and the bull shark, my personal favorite, are the top three on the IGFA, which is the International Game Fishing Association's top predator list. So the great white, the tiger, and the bull shark.
Do you dive up here north, or do you go down to the islands? Or where do you go?
Both. A lot of divers here in the New York area, because of the climate that we deal with, of course, in the Northeast, don't do a lot of diving offshore here. They'll do diving in freshwater grottos or lakes that are set up for diving here in New York, Pennsylvania. There are a lot of freshwater grottos. That's where I dive.
But there's no sharks in there. So when you do sharks, you dive the Caribbean, basically?
The Caribbean, yes. Caribbean reef sharks down in Bahamas. I've dove with whale sharks down in Honduras. And it's indescribable, the feeling that you get diving with these animals.
How big do they get?
Whale sharks can grow up to 65 feet, and weigh, of course, several tons. And ironically, they are the largest fish in the ocean. They are also the most gentle, or one of the most gentle. They have baleen plates and very, very small teeth, so they're only able to eat very small crustaceans and fish. They are not the classic Jaws
that would
or
be krill,
great white.
Basically,
it'd
right?
be krill, exactly. And they're easy animal to study in as much as their migration patterns are pretty accessible and been charted by researchers. And they're just amazing, amazing fish.
So have you swum with whale sharks?
Yes. Yes.
And do you have any fear at all when you're with them? You know they're gentle, but one wrong flip of that tail and you're probably history, right?
Well, it's interesting. You know, they have very specific rules in diving with these animals. And the first thing that struck me the first time I saw one underwater was how enormous it is. I wasn't shocked or afraid of being attacked. It's just when you encounter an animal that large for the first time underwater, it's an amazing thing. You do kind of step back like, Jesus, this thing's big.
So there was no fear that he would attack you?
No, none whatsoever.
But just, my goodness, I'm in the way of something that doesn't really care that I'm here, and he could bump into me or something like that.
Yeah, you have to be careful of the fin, the tail fin of their.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It could be a problem if you get in the way, but other than that, they pose no threat to man whatsoever.
Have you swum with? You've swum with more of. Sharks that are sized more like we expect them to be, maybe 10, 12 foot?
Yes. That would be some of the white-tip reef sharks and the Caribbean reef sharks. These animals, again, you know, they have been vilified by the press and the media since Jaws, you know, in 75, to be vicious, mindless animals. And research is showing around the world that these animals have, they're not only intelligent, but that they have a purpose in the larger oceanic ecosystem. They are apex predators, just like bears and lions and tigers. They breed very slowly. They take time to reach sexual maturity. And nature does that so that they can keep the number of these apex predators under control, because they don't want them, nature doesn't want them outnumbering the prey items. Obviously, that would throw off the entire... Well,
that's just the basic sure. evolution. All animals, cockroaches serve a purpose, ants serve a purpose. They
absolutely.
They eat our detritus. They,
right.
Without scavengers, we'd be over our head. We would drown in filth.
Absolutely.
That's what they're there for.
The irony for the shark being it's a public relations issue for the shark. We kill hundreds of millions of sharks a year, being human beings, whereas on an average year, anywhere from 6 to 15 people may die from a shark attack. So when you run those numbers, they have a lot more to fear from us than we do from them.
Are they endangered or threatened, any particular species, or sharks in general?
Sharks in general are endangered. A lot of the pelagic, meaning open water species, they are finding are being victimized by industrial longline fishing industry, which goes out and trawls the ocean bottom and sets out thousands and thousands of hooks and are basically... raping the oceans is the only term that I can think of.
Well, tell us about those trawlers that, which actually drag the bottom. They destroy the coral and whatever else is down there. It's like some big net comes down and goes through New York City trawling for humans and knocks down all the buildings while they're doing it. Something
exactly.
like that, isn't it?
Exactly.
So, is there no consciousness in any government or any organization? The Jacques Cousteau people, the mm-hmm. WCS.
Right.
Does anybody have any influence, or does it just become politics and stay away from us? This is how we make our living.
Basically, it's a combination of both. From what I've seen, you know, there are aquariums, excuse me, and foundations around the country, around the world, that have been screaming to their local governments for years for changes in industrial fishing because of the impact that it's having on the marine ecosystem. A lot of that falls on deaf ears because large industrial fishing companies can pay their local politicians or whomever to go out and take care of business. It's not the local fisherman who is you know, catching fish for his village or his family that anybody worries about, but it's seriously the industrial longline fishermen that are doing a tremendous amount of damage to the ecosystem.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, it's the longline fishermen and those big I don't know what the nets are called, mm-hmm. probably the same longline fishermen,
right.
that are responsible for the endangering of the loggerhead turtles and other
yes.
wildlife as well.
Yes. It you gotta understand that the marine ecosystem, 90% of the world's oceans have yet to be explored. Researchers have only explored about 1% of the sea floor, so there's a lot we don't know. Even though when you turn on Discovery Channel, you see Shark Week every year and things of that nature. There are researchers around the world and shark activists like myself who are finding out more and more information about these animals. But there's still so much we don't know. And to try to calculate the impact on an ecosystem that we're just beginning to understand by, again, longline fishing and a lot of other influences that are destroying the marine environment, we just can't say at this point. So it's certainly not good, definitely.
Well, you know, we think of the sea as a cornucopia, unlimited supply.
Right.
You go to the fish market, you buy fish. That's it. That's never going to change.
Right.
But in fact, is the sea a cornucopia? I keep reading how certain fisheries are tapped,
mm-hmm.
How they fish ever deeper
mm-hmm.
and go ever wider for
right.
fish.
Right.
There are new species showing up in fish markets that weren't there before and mm-hmm. old ones that have disappeared. Well, the old ones that have disappeared are gone. Like
right.
you don't see cod much anymore,
right.
which used to be very plentiful.
Right.
Now you get this, what they call a Chilean sea bass, which is the Patagonian toothfish, which is probably endangered. They have
exactly.
to go very deep for those.
Right.
Will the oceans run out? If so, when? And you as a father, you have this consciousness, which we discussed.
True.
How is this going to impact? And he's a what is he, three, two?
He's 2 years old.
He's
yeah,
two, right?
Yeah.
He's got a long life.
Yes.
You and me, what the hell, buddy? He's got a long life. What does he have to look forward to just in terms of supply of fish? Just that.
I'd say that from what I've seen, the research that I have seen, within the next decade or two, there's already a viable impact going on in the oceans right now. There's no doubt about that. Researchers from all over the world, scientists, biologists can tell you that with research that they've done and correlated over the last decade or so. It is not, like you said, an inexhaustible food source for human beings. The yellowfin tuna, for instance, which is endangered right now, is a pelagic fish that crosses many, many boundaries as far as country water boundaries are concerned. So if you, let's say, enact laws in the United States and the coastal waters of the United States banning yellowfin tuna, then right outside the coastal waters of the United States, along a Chinese fishing company can come along out in the middle of the ocean and fish for longfin tuna, for yellowfin tuna, rather. And, you know, it's very hard to regulate or set laws worldwide with every type of government to protect these animals. Researchers, again, are doing a miraculous job around the world getting local governments to understand the impact. A lot of them have changed the minds of even generational fishermen who have now turned toward ecotourism as a way to either to replace their income as fishermen or to get an education themselves on the fact that if they overfish their particular area, that it's going to impact them economically, directly.
Well, what do you think about people like Captain Watson of the Sea Shepherd? He goes out there and in the deep ocean and he mm-hmm. blocks Japanese fishing boats that are whalers that are trying right. to kill whales. Right. And wherever there's actual laws broken, mm-hmm. He captures the lawbreakers and brings them in. But even sure. when there's no law, he's out there.
Yes.
But now I guess those are international waters.
Yeah.
Do you support those kind of revolutionary tactics?
I support any revolutionary act or any act that is law-abiding, that doesn't harm any human beings or any animals, obviously. And it's simply the right thing to do. I mean, he would be called an eco-terrorist by some, I'm sure. And he would be called...
Long live the eco-terrorist.
Exactly. He would be called, an activist or an environmentalist by others.
And a terrorist by others. We have a call, Eric. Who do we have there, Rob?
You have Mr. Cam from New Rochelle.
Hi, Mr. Cam.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I just tuned in here. And, of course, this has been discussed before, although it should be discussed to apprise us of the problem. The question is, what kind of solution is out there? Until population growth slows down and reverses, we're not going to be able to get a grip on this problem. The financial pressure will be there to keep going, and we'll never catch up with it. The one country that has the largest GNP and whose population is growing, I think the only one of the larger countries, is the United States. Mm. The European populations are falling. Japan, the population's falling. The reason ours is growing is solely due to immigration. If it weren't for immigration, we would begin a slow fall. So until we start to think about that and enforcing the laws and so on, which we're the only country that doesn't do that for a variety of reasons.
Do you have a question for Eric Byron?
Well, you keep asking me if I have a question.
And you keep saying, does he agree with me?
And the question is, do you agree with my statement?
Thanks, Mr. Kemp.
Yes, I do to a certain extent. There are laws that are set by state and federal governments here in the United States that protect certain endangered species. Unfortunately, it's a bureaucracy and it's red tape, and the species that should be protected aren't being protected at a rate that will guarantee their survival. So yes, population, supply and demand of any country on its food source, on its food supply, definitely has an impact. So I agree with your statement as far as that's concerned. Regulating it, however, like you mentioned, is going to be extremely difficult governmentally. It'll be extremely difficult environmentally and politically, of course. You know, whenever there's money involved, the industrial longline fishermen or companies pay a lot of money, I'm sure, to the local politicians and governments to be able to go out and do what they do. So it's it's a multi-pronged problem that doesn't have a simple solution. But yes, I do agree with some of your statement.
Well, thank you for agreeing with me, and have a good day.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kam. Yes. You are listening to Environmentally Sound on WVOX AM 1460 in New Rochelle. If you are listening in Munich, Germany, Oran, Algeria, Dakar, Senegal, Abidjan, Ivory Coast, or Reykjavik, Iceland, you have logged on to www.wvox.com, and you are listening live. My name is Bob Levensold. I am your host, and my guest is Eric Byron, who is a member of the dive team at the Brooklyn Aquarium, but so much more. He is a biologist and a shark expert. Eric.
Yes.
Will our toxic practices cause many populations to crash? Now we're talking about not just overfishing, but the deep sea dumping of PCBs, dioxins, whatever other industrial waste, which they undoubtedly do. I can't prove it. I have not followed anyone out into the deep oceans.
Right.
But I will bet everything I got, the ranch, the rent, the mortgage, everything, that one way that industry disposes of these very difficult to dispose chemicals, which are toxic, which are carcinogenic, which cost a lot of money to do properly, I'm sure that they are in collusion with big fat ship guys, and they say, sure, we'll dump your stuff in the oceans. What effect does this toxic
waste have? A tremendous effect on the marine ecosystem. Anything man-made potentially has an effect. Something that is toxic, something that is endangered, dangerous to any biological species that comes in contact with it, be it human, be it mammal, fish, whatever, is a problem. And I have no doubt, like you touched on, that these practices are going on illegally around the world, maybe more so in other countries than here. But yes, it is all like I mentioned before with the other caller, it's a multi-pronged problem. We touched on overfishing, we touched on how that impacts the eco, the marine environment, pollution, and illegal dumping of toxic chemicals absolutely can destroy a coral reef in a very, very short period of time. A coral reef is comprised of small animals. A lot of people think it's either plant or rock. No, they're actually animals. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, a coral reef can take 50,000, 100,000 years to propagate to a viable reef system. So man can come along and destroy that in 15, 20 minutes.
And we've done that. So, and in fact, let me just say something I know about Jacques Cousteau. Jacques Cousteau did a special. He was a great loss when he died a few years ago.
Yes.
He did a special. He dove, I think it was in Antarctic waters. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly where. But he went and it was alive with fish. It was the fish were bumping into each other. They needed traffic cops.
Sure.
He went back a few years later. Nothing. It was dead.
Right.
Is that happening worldwide?
I'm sure it is. It is happening worldwide. And the problem is, even when laws are enacted to protect species and protect territorial waters by certain countries, you know, the ocean is so huge and so vast. How do you police this? I mean, you send out police boats in every direction?
Why not?
We'd love to see that. Yeah, that would be an environmentalist dream.
It's like poachers in the African jungles and
sure,
in other places.
Sure.
Why not go after them? I say you shoot poachers on sight. You don't even... If they say, well, this is just subsistence of my family, well, your family can eat you now. Now you're the bush meat now. And I feel the same way about people that destroy our environment, because these are not just minor little crimes. They're impacting the human race.
Yes.
Us, your cute little son. Who
we touched on it
wanted
before
to get rid
we
of
went on
himself.
Air. Al Gore, who just won the Nobel Peace Prize for his environmental work, and I applaud him, has basically chimed in on, more than chimed in on global warming and the effects that is having with the environment and what we can do as human beings to impact that positively. All of this ties in. Everything that I learn, everything that I see, everything that I read, every researcher I talk to from different disciplines of environmental science basically say the same thing, and that's the environment and nature is one entity. It cannot be viewed as just the ocean, just the land, just a tree, just a shark, everything is interactive. Everything has a cause and effect, which will filter down to human beings in one way, shape, or form.
So in the minute we have left, Eric Byron, have we gone too far? Has the human race already laid the foundation for its own extinction or near extinction. Is there any way to come back, or are we toast?
No, we're not toast. There is hope, fortunately. Again, you know, there are organizations around the world that fight tooth and nail to enact, getting laws enacted by the governments to make sure that these things are protected. We as human beings, again, have an impact in this. If we stop what we're doing now, or if we regulate it to the point where it can become manageable, the oceans can recover. If we keep doing what we're doing, then in a shorter period of time as 2 or 3 decades, we could see a very negative impact on the marine environment, which will, of course, impact us.
Well, I'm glad you're so optimistic. I am not. I think we are toast. I think if not,
I hope not.
If the species does not go extinct, millions will die in the next generation through global warming. Of course, is the pop disaster coming.
Sure.
But has anybody noticed that the bees have disappeared? Bees which pollinate all of our foodstuffs.
CCD. They're falling from. Yeah.
That's right. I forget exactly what it is, but it's the hives collapse. Hive collapse.
Yeah,
I think it's HCV, whatever.
Disorder, yeah.
Well, we're about out of time, so we have much more we could talk about. I thank you for being here. And
Bob, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure. Okay. I'd like to thank Jeff Rook and Shannon Wilson for their time and for Eric Byron for joining me in the studio today. As I frequently remind listeners, our world is slipping inexorably into the toilet. Not much more I can do about it than I already do, but I applaud the efforts of those conscious men and women like Eric Byron and my other guests who do what they can to try to stop that slide. At the bottom is the big hit toward which the human species seems hell-bent on heading. To quote the 60s musical Hair, "What a piece of work is man." Yes, I agree. We are pieces of work, each individually and all together. Unfortunately, our negative outweighs a positive. Our thought for the week: man has lost the capacity to foresee and to forestall. He will end by destroying the earth. That was Rachel Carson dedicating her book Silent Spring to Albert Schweitzer. Thank you very much for listening. Remember to be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. You are here. It is now. Health and happiness to you all.
Live from New York's Golden Apple, this is the flagship station of the Whitney Radio Network, 1460 WVON.
I'm Ed Donahue. On Capitol Hill, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke was asked about the chances of a recession. He wouldn't speculate, but he does see a turnaround in the economy.
Our assessment is for slower growth, but positive growth going into next year. We think that by the spring.
Senator Charles Schumer is chairman of Congress's Joint Economic Committee. He wants the government to do something about the credit crunch.
Now, as we face an economic slowdown or worse, I'm very worried it's those Americans who haven't shared in our recent growth who will bear the brunt of economic decline, and that the policies of this administration will only further exacerbate their difficulties.
Stocks are mixed right now. The S&P 500 up 3 points. The Dow is down about a point. The NASDAQ down 23. The price of oil is still